Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Lancet Healthy Longevity in Conversation With. I am Sophie Rader, the senior editor of the journal, and today I am joined by Lara Pivodic from VUB and Ghent University to discuss her paper on social connections in older people and how these connections predict end-of-life outcomes. Thank you very much for joining me today. So, although previous research has demonstrated the effect of social connections on health outcomes overall, so across different age groups, there's very little research exploring this in people nearing the end of life. So could you begin by discussing why social connections are particularly important to assess in this specific population of people who are in the final stages of life?
Yes. So there's quite a bit of research on social connection and health in general. And what it has largely found is that social connection does have a really large effect on health. And the outcome that was mostly assessed to measure health was mortality. So the question was usually, do people who have better social connections live longer? And the answer was, in most studies, yes, they live longer. And the effects of social connection are, the effects of poor social connection are comparable to some of like the more common known risk factors for mortality, such as smoking, for instance. So we know that really well, but health was mainly defined or rather operationalized as living longer. And that makes sense. It's an important indicator of health, of course. But then when we look at other groups, such as people with a chronic illness or people who are dying, especially, or people who are at the end of life, there the most appropriate indicator of health would not be will they live longer, because by definition, they are nearing the end of life. But at the same time, the concept of health still remains important, even for people who are at the end of life, or people with a serious chronic illness, where health is not necessarily the absence of illness, but we look at broader indicators of well-being, such as people, do people have, or are they free of certain symptoms? Do they feel well where they are, and so on? And we have very little evidence on that. So we know social connection is potentially a very, or most likely, is a very powerful force for people's health, but we don't know how it affects those indicators of health that are important in those groups who will not live longer.
So what were the aims of your study, and how do these aims build on existing research?
The aims of this study were twofold. One was to understand how social connection changes over time as people near the end of life. And the other aim, or the second aim, was how social connection a few years prior to death, or 1 or 2 years prior to death, that was the case in our sample, impacts end-of-life outcomes. And specifically, those were symptoms that people experience at the end of life, healthcare utilization, and where they die, so place of death. In general, as for understanding how social connection changes, there is very little longitudinal research on the end of life. So research that follows the same group of people repeatedly over a period of time until they die. And that's not because we don't want to do it or we're not interested, but it's because it's so difficult to do. It's difficult to follow people up, to do repeated measurements when people are in poor health, to do it in a way that doesn't overburden them, and to obtain good data with little missing data. Given the difficulties of obtaining such data, there are some remarkable studies done in our field. But overall, we don't know trajectories really well. And there is, and especially trajectories of social trajectories, so trajectories of social connection. And there's a general assumption based on some research that social trajectories generally decline. But that's a really general statement. And we wondered, my co-authors and I, well, how does this apply to different people? And do they really decline? And in what way do they decline? What is social connection? Which aspects of social connection decline and which don't? And we had some doubts because some qualitative research on the end of life shows that some relationships strengthen for people, that they say that their social networks become smaller, there are fewer activities they can do with people, but they don't necessarily feel that's worsening their connections. So that, together with really not knowing which aspects of social connection do or perhaps don't deteriorate, this is why we set out to study changes in social connection using a clear framework to choose which variables to study. And Julianne Holt-Lundstad's framework of social connection is a very influential one which we use. And she distinguishes structure components, So basically, it's the absence or presence of relationships, such as marital status, living alone or with others. Function components of social connection, sort of what do we receive from these social connections? Social support, also loneliness is part of the social connection, part of the function component. And she distinguishes a quality component, which is really about how do we evaluate these social connections. And so what we wanted to do is really study the changes in these three components separately over time in people's last years of life. And then for the second aim was to study the impact of social connection on end-of-life outcomes. And again, there are very few studies that investigated this. As we were preparing this study, we looked at which ones did and how many other, and we found four. All were from North America. They were three from the US using data of the Health and Retirement Study, and one from Canada. So they were all from North America. Only one of them combined a longitudinal data collection with an end-of-life interview specifically designed to study the last year of life. And they found some very divergent findings, mainly also because of differences in operationalization. They didn't use a clear framework to really say why are they measuring these particular outcomes. Of course, most studies work with the data they have, especially if it's these large population-based studies. And one study found indeed that loneliness predicted symptom burden at the end of life. So what we set out to do is to conduct the first study of social connection at the end of life in a large and representative sample outside of North America, combining a longitudinal study using data of SHARE, of the SHARE study, with the end-of-life interview with proxy respondents that's conducted as part of SHARE. So we could really link these two and study specifically the last year of life.
So what were the key findings of your study? And specifically, how do these key findings compare with, as you said, the very little previous research findings? And on a broader level, how might these findings inform or maybe even challenge current prevailing notions of social health in later life?
We found that different measures of social connection evolve in very multifaceted ways as older people near the end of life. Overall, on average, across the sample, there were no large changes. And that was quite surprising in itself. The largest changes were obviously in social support, or the question was rather, do people receive personal care or help from others? That increased substantially because as people near the end of life, they were more ill, they needed more help. And fewer people were married, meaning more people were widowed, because also their spouses aged. And that was a big change in social connection or in the social domain, of course, for people. And those were the largest changes. And one can say those were those that are really directly linked to health, to increasing disability. And then we come to the other variables that become a bit more complex. So for instance, loneliness did increase as well on average towards the end of life, but to a rather small extent. So over a period of on average 4 years, the increase was about 9% if we look at the scale that we used. It's very subjective, of course, especially looking at a big sample and average to judge is this a lot or not a lot. We interpreted it as a not a very large change. And it occurred in the context of social network sizes that remained quite stable, emotional closeness to social networks that people related as quite stable, and their satisfaction, which also they rated as quite stable. And what the other things that remain stable is contact frequency, for instance, with their social networks and a bit of geographical proximity in which they were. So the big challenge for us in interpreting this was also how do we reconcile these findings of somewhat increasing loneliness but stable social networks, stable emotional closeness. And then we went back to literature, of course, and we know there are low correlations of different measures of social connection. Holt Lundstad wrote and found empirically that the structure, function, and quality domain are poorly correlated among each other. So they measure different aspects. And so we know that these things are different experiences, which also says we need to measure them all if we want to understand social connection really well. So we know that loneliness is different from aloneness. People can be surrounded by others and feel lonely, or they can be by themselves and feel not lonely. The fact that satisfaction remains stable could also just be an indicator that people adapt to their illness and disability. They adapt to changing, to what they can do in life, and preserve stable satisfaction with their social networks. So what these findings do is they counter prevalent ideas of declining social trajectories. There are people for whom they decline. There are people for whom they remain stable or perhaps improve. What we couldn't do here, and I'll maybe touch upon this a bit later, is study the diversity among people. But in general, what we see is that these findings call for a much more complex understanding of the social health of older people, of their social life, especially as they're near the end of life. Also, social connection health likely have a bidirectional associations. Networks can also adapt to people's declining health. And then we also studied the impact of social connection end of life outcomes. And there we found, and also supported somewhat the finding from an earlier study in the US, that there is an association between higher loneliness and symptom experience at the end of life. So we found this association again. It was not a very strong association, but it's an indicator and needs to be studied further that people with better social connection may not only live longer, but when they die, as we all must, they perhaps die better, with fewer pain, with less anxiety or sadness, which were the symptoms that were measured in this study. But this is something that needs to be studied further. It needs to be substantiated further. We need to better understand the mechanisms behind this association, but it's a potentially important one. What we also found is that being married and receiving personal care or help makes death in hospital as opposed to home more likely. So in some way, the data suggests that perhaps receiving some kind of social support, either through marriage or through direct social support, assuming that being married provides this social support, that it may be predictive of dying in hospital. And this is a very surprising finding in our field, because most of the research, and again, this was research mainly conducted in the UK and in Western Europe and Northern Europe, suggests that having social support helps people die at home, because surveys show that this is what most people would prefer. Now, our study was conducted in 19 countries, 18 European countries, and in Israel, including European countries in the south and in the east, where palliative care at home is not as well developed. This is something we know. So these findings also show the importance of looking across geographical borders when looking at such associations, because it might mean that in these countries, dying in hospital might be a good choice or might be considered good care, and that having the social support, having an advocate to perhaps help you get into the hospital when your health deteriorates might be something good. So it's one of the other conclusions of this study, like really showing the importance of looking across borders.
Well, that's really interesting. And I imagine that for social connection, especially, there must be such a cultural element to it. So what you touched on this a little bit, but what are the implications of your findings for clinical practice and for policy? So for instance, for end of life care and palliative care services.
I think especially the findings on changes in social connection just remind us that we are all complex beings, that our social lives are complex, that they change in complex ways, especially as we navigate disruptive life circumstances such as a chronic illness, and that older people, even those who near the end of life, are no different, and that it applies to them as well. And at the same time, becoming socially isolated or lonely should not be seen as a normal part of aging or as a normal part of dying, because we do see that this carries problems for healthcare access, potentially also for symptoms, as we found. This is something, yes, we found by looking at the changes in social connection, but looking specifically at loneliness being a potential risk factor for poor end-of-life outcomes, I've already mentioned that this is an association that needs to be substantiated further, especially if we understand the mechanisms behind this, sort of what is it? Is it behavioral mechanisms? Is it physiological? Then it will help us a bit to understand to what extent does this need to influence screening efforts of clinical practice, in palliative care practice, for instance? Is this something that we need to pay particular attention to when following people at the end of life? At the same time, while this could have clinical implications, I'm also a bit hesitant to frame loneliness only as a clinical problem and then finding only a clinical solution to it. Because I think, and we know, that loneliness is a social problem. And it's not a problem of individuals or their individual families or somebody to blame. It's a problem of, I think, kind of like to say society, but it is a social, yeah, of our communities. And for instance, there are many countries, including the one I work in, which is Belgium, that cut back funding on community centers, on places where people could gather, on certain social services that are not clinical. And then at the same time, because the epidemiological data on loneliness in old age are overwhelming, then they suggest, oh, but we will make it easier for people to access a psychologist if they feel lonely. Which, again, I'm not saying that a psychologist can't help and that they shouldn't have this access, but I think that the solutions should be much more broader than a clinical solution if indeed loneliness is a risk factor for the end of life. Part of the solution might lie in much broader public health approaches to how we approach dying, how we approach care for those who are dying. There is a movement scientifically backed in our field that's called compassionate communities, which really are community building initiatives that are also being scientifically evaluated to help communities address the problem, or not the problem, but address the experience of illness, dying, and bereavement. And I think the solutions for that would lie there if these findings are further substantiated. So I think the solutions or palliative care services can provide an important contribution to relieving perhaps the distress of lonely people and to help them and to mitigate the effects of loneliness, because also palliative care works multidimensionally, but they can do it in isolation, not without input of wider communities.
No, that's really, really interesting. And I think also what you said, that, yeah, I think we don't really talk about death or having a good death very much. And I think it's one of those things that, again, prevailing notions, it's feared. And there's this, it isn't something that isn't, I guess, sort of, again, sort of cultural thing that we haven't really thought about equipping people with having a good death and what that means. And again, there's going to be variation in that. But yeah, I agree with you. I think isolation has, loneliness can't be looked at in isolation. I think it can start with very simple solutions like having community centers. So you, and this is something that you have now, you have spoke on this a few times about, particularly in terms of loneliness and looking at mechanisms. So you sort of answered this question, but looking ahead, are there other key areas or in terms of research that should be explored? And then how does your study and your study approach, how might that inform how future research is done?
I would say that what our study shows is the value of distinguishing the different concepts of social connection very clearly. And I would hope that this would encourage future research to do the same, to distinguish and to make it really clear why certain variables are studied, in which way and how. And that would just make it much, much easier to compare and to aggregate these findings in the future. Our work shows the importance of studying social connection, or I would say to conduct population-based studies on the end of life across geographical borders, because we will reach different conclusions when we take other countries into account than the usual suspects. And I said, we do confirm that there is something happening between loneliness and burdensome symptoms at the end of life that urgently warrants further study through a range of methods. And these methods need to include qualitative methods, ethnographic methods. Of course, bigger studies with larger samples will help us to explore better the diversity in different trajectories, which is something we also couldn't study in depth. We still look at average trajectories. So to study this diversity, to find more trajectories, we need bigger samples. But to really understand what's going on with people who are lonely and why they don't receive the pain treatment they need, we need to observe people, we need to speak to them, we need to interview them and their family carers. And another important implication of this work is, and perhaps readers of the article will notice that as well, and the outcomes we measured in the end of life interview are not ideal to measure or to look at symptoms at the end of life. They are limited. They are focused on pain. The psychological or psychosocial outcomes are anxiety or sadness, which is a proxy for depression, I assume. So it's again very clinical, and this is because we use data from an existing study, from the SHARE survey, which is phenomenal, which is great, and it's remarkable and really good that they have an end of life interview. And of course, in these big surveys, you always have choices. What do we measure? What is absolutely necessary? And what do we leave out? And you can't measure everything. But I would hope that in the SHARE survey, but also in other longitudinal aging studies, that we can improve these measures in the end of life interviews a little more, by perhaps working more in, or by collaborating across disciplines, and by really looking what are the most important measures of health and well-being, sort of the broader notions of well-being that we need to capture. And then I think we could, especially given that we have this infrastructure, we have these great surveys already, we have their sampling methods and their quality assurance, and perhaps by adding two or three relevant variables, we could reach conclusions that are so much more valuable.
What kind of outcomes, so beyond clinical outcomes, do you think are particularly important to consider in future research?
Yes, I think there are clinical outcomes that are still relevant. Yeah. Of course, we need to look at pain. I would distinguish the psychosocial outcomes a bit more. So, for instance, now the question is anxiety or sadness, but you don't know which of the two is a problem. The pain question, to be very technical, is: has this person had pain or received medication for pain? Which I understand from a content point, like you combine them, but for our analysis it was quite difficult. Sometimes when we found an association, we didn't know, for instance, there was an association between pain and being married. I doubt that those who are married had more pain, but those who were married had more access to pain medication. So we found this association, but we didn't put much weight on it because it was really difficult to interpret. But then also, of course, there are social outcomes to look at, which are not covered in the end of life interviews for now. There are sort of palliative care is considered to consist of, there are four domains of palliative care: the physical, psychological, social, and spiritual. And often the social and the spiritual are not so well covered in these surveys. I would like to know, for instance, if the person felt at peace. That can be one question towards the end of life, if they again, I'm also aware that there are so many things, and people from different fields will find so many fields important. Somebody who, an economist, would want to know much more about inheritance, for instance, and I'm not in a place to say that ours is more important, but I would really like to have still an interdisciplinary reevaluation of what we assess in the end of life.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, because I think the focus often is things, these very clinical outcomes like pain and pain symptoms. But yeah, I think something, yeah, I think looking beyond that, and I think an interdisciplinary approach is, it's not done very often. So that is very interesting.
Thank you so much to Lara Pivadic for joining me today, and to all of you for listening. The paper we discussed can be found on our website in the April issue and is open access. Remember that you can subscribe to The Lancet Healthy Longevity in Conversation With wherever you usually get your podcasts. Thank you, and see you next time.